Well, I hope you found the series really helpful. We're finishing it tonight. We've been doing this series on how do you fix the world, and we've had four big responses that we got, and we've gone through them week by week. This is the last one we're looking at, and it's the smallest, well, of the four big ones, it's the smallest response. There are other responses, but this one, really, there's 17% of people who said, in answer to the question, how would you fix the world, they said, look, you can't. It's just unfixable. We can't fix it. Now, I don't know whether that's you tonight, whether you've come along because that was your response and it's the way you think. That is a really down way of thinking, isn't it? It is a very pessimistic response. You just can't fix it. Now, it's my view that most people on the Central Coast, and probably throughout Australia, but most people on the Central Coast, I think in practice, operate with this view. They may not articulate it, they may not say it out loud that that's my position, but the way many of us live our lives pretty much effectively expresses the idea that we don't think it can be fixed, because very much what happens on the Central Coast and in other areas, but places like the Central Coast, where you've got the beautiful coast, you've got this lifestyle, you've got kind of the wonderful area we're in, most people, what happens is they say, look, I'm just going to build a house, I'm going to get a good job, and I'm going to use as many of my weekends as I can to enjoy life, and I'm going to get the family, and I'm going to protect the family and get the kids the best school. And I mean, the world sucks, there's so many things wrong, but I can't do anything about it, and I'm not even sure we can do it. I'm just going to focus in on me and my family, because I'm not selfish, but it'll be my family. I'm going to focus in on me and my family, and we're going to make the best we can of this life we've got. And we're just going to work to make this an oasis where we can be safe and protected while we can. Now, I think effectively that's saying we can't fix the world. People have given up. But I want to actually wrestle with that question. Can it be fixed? Is that the right response? Is it the right response in terms of can it be fixed? Is it the right response in what to do when it can't be fixed? How do you respond? Well, in part, it depends on what you mean by being fixed. But the problem, there's a problem in the world, isn't it? It's called death. And it's interesting, as I talk with people, it's very slow for that to ever dawn on people that that's a problem and that it needs fixing. And my guess is that what happens for most people is that because for us it is so obvious we can't fix it and it's so horrible, we have decided as a culture to, as much as possible, shut it out of our consciousness. And so we don't see death. We don't have people that rushed off to a hospital. They're taken away from us. They're put in a morgue. And we don't even see it. We keep it away from it as much as possible. We don't talk about it. We don't think on it, and so on. And I think it's because we're aware deep in the background that it's one thing we can't fix, and so let's ignore it. Now, death is a very serious issue, of course, and it is a real problem. But let me say, I think it is a big problem, but it is not even the biggest problem that we have. Now, mine tonight has the potential to be a real, real downer. But here's the thing, there is hope, but the hope that you get about the future only comes through the downer that we have to have. Can you fix the world? The answer I think the Bible gives quite clearly is we can't. We can't. It is unfixable. Now, that's partly because of understanding what the problems are. If the problems are simply finances, economics, the issues of poverty and wealth distribution, we can fix that to some degree. Now, Jesus says the poor will always be with you, but we've made a great fist of moving forward on that issue so that poverty rates around the world have dropped. It's been astonishing to see what we have done as we've sought to redistribute and bring various things to bear. We have made real changes. We've eradicated various diseases. We've made real changes. But the problems are far deeper and far more serious. Here we are sitting in this country, and we are very wealthy. There is still, of course, an inequality, but it's an inequality amongst people who are fairly well off. And the issue, interesting thing is that despite the fact that our wealth has multiplied by 3-4 times in the last 50 years, we still, behind every door in every house, have high levels of depression, higher than we've ever had before. dysfunctionality, breakdown in marriage, breakdown in relationships. There's despair, there's fear, there's tensions, there's racism developing more and more. These problems are the real problems. And you add into the mix death, and although we can fix technological issues, although we can fix economies and diseases, we can't fix the real problems. They are with us and continue with us. Now, I said to you a moment ago that death is a great problem. I'm suggesting it's the second greatest problem, because the greatest problem that stops us ever being able to fix the world is far greater than even death. And it's not actually been mentioned. I think I've alluded to it once or twice as we've gone through this series. And the thing I'm going to mention, which is the great problem that means we cannot fix the world, it's often a shock when people hear it for the first time. Let me take you to it. It's in Romans chapter 8. Now, it'll come up on the screen there. If you've got your Bible, just have a quick open to it. And we won't be spending a great deal of time in it, but I want to draw your attention to one verse in Romans chapter 8. Have a look there at number 20. For the creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope. Now notice that. The creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who did the subjecting. Who is that one? Who is the one who subjected the world to frustration, to futility, to an inability to get past where it's at, to being bound and stuck in death, actually, futility? Who's the one who subjected the world to futility? It's God. It's God. Now, it's irreverent perhaps to say it like that, that he's the problem. But it is clear that we are, and our world is, locked into an inability to move forward. And it's because, says the Bible, ultimately, God has bound us up into the futility we're in, the frustration, the inability to achieve the purpose for which we're made, and the feeling that comes with it, the frustration of seeing something before us but not being able to get there. And the key thing that locks us into that is death, which God himself has sentenced us to. It's death that makes all things futile. For all your efforts through life to get ahead, to succeed, to build a career, to get healthy and fit, aging and then death takes it away from you. For all your kind of efforts to develop relationships and family and grow together and enjoy each other, as you go on years and years and years, sickness starts to intrude, and then untimely death, and then timely death. Death ultimately takes away everyone you love. Death will take away everyone that you love, and will take you away as well. All of that brings us constantly to futility. And God has brought this to us. And all of this is beyond any possibility of humanity changing. We are bound to it by God. Now, when people first hear this, sometimes they respond with a kind of bravado, the kind of testosterone kind of fueled response, which is, well, God's bound us to this. Well, let me show him. I'm going to actually not be the one to be bound up by it. I'm going to actually break through. If God is against you, you have no hope. Who do you think he is? He is not just one of us, but larger. God is the creator of the universe. He is the one who holds the sun in place. He spins the earth and causes it to... He's the one who upholds it every moment, who gives you every breath. At the moment of taking your heartbeat away, he just takes your heart and you are gone. If God is against us, there is no hope. Well, the next response probably that comes is a kind of finger pointing. So God's against us? How dare he? I don't know if you've seen, someone sent it through to me just yesterday, the Stephen Fry rant against God. Now, I think it'll do the rounds on Facebook, so most of you will pick it up at some point. So Stephen Fry is a British entertainer. He's a very funny man. He's a very clever man, and he on various movies and so on. And he's just been in the media recently because he's married his boyfriend. He's a young man that he's linked up with, and he's just got married to him. And but he was asked on a worldview kind of show by the interviewer what you would say to God. And listen what he would say to God. How dare you? How dare you create a world to which there is such misery that's not our fault? It's not right. It's utterly, utterly evil, is what he would say to God. He called God capricious, mean, and stupid. Now, apart from the outrageous arrogance of a man to talk like that to our Creator, that he can claim to know enough to be able to judge God like that is itself such arrogance. But it fails to appreciate our part in why God has responded to us the way he has. Let me explain that again. The Bible tells us the great problem we have is that God is against us. Well, how dare he, says Stephen Fry. Well, he fails to appreciate why God is against us. Our part in why God has subjected us to futility and frustration. Why has God done this? Well, we've looked at it a couple of weeks ago, but let me just remind you briefly in Mark chapter 7, an important piece of teaching by Jesus, which I want to unpack for us in a moment. But Jesus himself says this, "It is from within, out of a person's heart, that evil thoughts come." Why is there sexual immorality in the world? Why is there greed? Why is there murder, theft? Why is there deceit, envy, slander, arrogance, and folly? Why are these things all in the world? Jesus says they're in the world because they've come from inside us. They've come from our hearts. No one's imposed it on us. It's not that we just tripped up and accidentally. It's actually that we manufacture these things from our nature, which is itself corrupted, broken, fallen. Now, I've said this a number of times. We've looked at the scriptures on this a number of times. I want to tonight try something new to try and get us to see this in a fresh way. For the last little while, I've been reading a book called Shantung Compound. And it's a fascinating book. And it's a book that tells the story of a man in China during the Second World War who was teaching in China when the war broke out and decided to stay on. Now, of course, the Japanese took over China, so he's now in enemy territory. He was an American. But he decided to stay on, along with a bunch of other Americans and British and other European and South Africans and so on. They stayed on in China for various reasons. Some were missionaries, some were medical personnel and so on, and that's where their livelihood was for many of them. They stayed on. But come Pearl Harbor, the Japanese decided, because of security issues, to round up all the non-Japanese, all the non-Asian, and to house them, imprison them in compounds. Now, this is quite a unique circumstance. They're not rounding up soldiers who'd been fighting against them. They're rounding up non-combatants. So the way the Japanese treated them was somewhat freer. But what they did was they rounded up all the people in this particular region and they put them into an abandoned mission station that had been used and abused for many decades and would fallen into disrepair. But this mission statement, they dumped 1,800, 2,000 people into this mission station that was no bigger than our block of land. So suddenly, within a week or so, 2,000 people, 1,800 people or so, landed into this place, all from different nationalities, and they were imprisoned. They were given raw ingredients for food and left. Now, it's quite an extraordinary experience for them because the author of this book lived through 2.5, 3 years of that experience. And he called it an extraordinary social experiment where he had an opportunity to see, without kind of authorities imposing on them anything, they let them go pretty much, how a group of humans would interact and develop over this 2-3 year period. And when they arrived, the toileting was a mess. They weren't geared to deal with 2,000 people. There was no pipes. There was nothing. There was just raw food supplies. There were no beds. There were no medical. And because there weren't soldiers over them, pretty much, there was no authority structures. It was just completely left. Now, for Gilkey, the author, I'm going to mention a couple of things he says. He arrived in this place with a sense that humans have great potential. This man who writes the book, he grew up in America, in the Bible Belt areas of America, with a religious background, and he grew up in what's called a liberal Christian home. So the home that he was in had Christian convictions, but they were liberal Christian convictions. They were of the view that humans are basically good and that humanity can progress, and there was great optimism about where we're going and so on. And so Gilkey arrives with this crowd of people, and he arrives with the sense that humans have great potential. He kept a journal through the whole time. He kept a journal because it was such a life-changing experience for him. Now, in the early stages of his time there, he was very much affirmed in his view that humans have great potential. Because within 2 months, this crowd of people had brought order to this mess. They had engineers amongst them. They solved the toileting problems and worked out teams and managed the way of actually handling the waste. They had some medical staff who were kind of in prison with them as well. They created a hospital with a surgery and the whole deal. They had some people who used to work in the food industry, and they created teams who ran the kitchen and after a very short time began to produce food, 3 meals a day for 2,000 people. They established leadership structures all through the place. At the end of these first months, Gilkey said this: "I felt that man's ingenuity in dealing with difficult problems was unlimited." And he then felt that it made irrelevant, in his words, those so-called deeper issues of spiritual life with which religions pretend to deal. So what happened with this man was, he came with this kind of liberal Christian view of lovely things about people, and he saw in the camp how amazing humans were in bringing order out of chaos and developing all these systems of life together and solving problems. And he concluded that religion has no relevance. What does it add when we, with our ingenuity, can do all kinds of stuff and move humanity forward? So whatever religious pretensions he had, he gave up. But then, in his words, new sorts of problems kept arising. And they were problems not of a breakdown of technology, but a breakdown of character. They were moral problems. And these moral breakdowns were so serious that he says they threatened the very existence of the community. We've solved all the sanitation problems. We've solved the food problems. We've solved the medical problems. We've solved the house. We've got roofs over our heads. But the moral problems began to actually tear the whole thing apart from the inside. And he gives a number of examples, and there's many of them. And I've tried to discipline myself and only give you a quick couple to give you a taste of it. But let me give you two. The first one was a housing issue, which was a fairly simple one. The place was massively overcrowded, 1,800 people lumped into a place as big as our block here. You can imagine everyone having to sleep in small rooms and so on. One case came to him where there was 11 men in a small room no bigger than your bedroom. Sort of a bit bigger, but they were all kind of, they were stuck up bed upon bed and they couldn't even turn over. Now this group of men realised that across the hall was a room exactly the same size with 9 men in it. So they came with a very simple suggestion, actually a demand for justice. And they said to Gilkey, who was on the committee for housing, that you must give us justice in this case. You must move one man from our room to the other room so that there are 10 in each room. Now Gilkey heard this and thought, simple. Here is a clear-cut case. It's such an easy fix. The problem was clear. Injustice was clear. The solution is clear. Move one man from 11 into the 9, 10 in each. And so with a confidence in human nature, he went along to the nine men in the room and listened to what happened. When I entered the dorm and said that I was from the housing committee, at once I could feel the inmates becoming wary. Their suspicions, I noted, did not decrease when they saw the three-man deputation from the next room behind me. Then when I began to talk about the problem that had brought me here, their hostility came out in the open. One rather hard British engineer summed up the sentiments of the men standing around with these words. "Sure, we're sorry for those chaps over there, but what has that got to do with us? We're plenty crowded here as it is, and their worries are their tough luck. Listen, old boy, we're not crowding up for you or for anybody." Another man just simply said, "If you try and put someone in here, we'll throw them out, and if you come back to tell us we should, we'll throw you out." Others weren't so aggressive. Some tried to stand and argue and reason the case, trying to not be emotional about it all, and they argued the whole matter, expressing their doubts as to the wisdom of this particular course, making it even. But they argued the wisdom of the course and even said, "Why did you pick on us?" Now, Gilkey has this reaction to it all. He was shocked. He thought humans basically good, a clear case of injustice, simple fix, but they wouldn't listen. And he said this: "Do men really value their moral excellence or their own comfort and security?" He actually expected when things were tough that the innate goodness in humans would come out. But instead, he said, self-interest seemed almost all-powerful next to the weak claims of logic and fair play. Now, that wasn't an isolated instance. He said that for every case that came before them, it was the same. Quote, "Not only would people fail to see the fairness of any action that threatened their welfare, often they would refuse to even consider the issue." What it caused him to do was to realise that the human heart isn't quite like he thought it was. There was another very stark case. There was one very, I wish I could tell you more, but I'll give you one more case which was very stark. It concerned a dispute over families and their allocations of rooms. When they all arrived in the camp, the Japanese, as a first allocation, gave, there was about 50 families, parents with kids. And the parents with kids of teenagers, the Japanese gave two rooms to. A 3x4 metre bedroom to the parents and a 3x4 metre bedroom to the two teenagers. Families with young children, toddlers and infants, they gave one room to, 3x4. Now, I don't know if that freaks you out, but if you ever have kids one day, to be stuck in the same room day in, day out with a child is a nightmare. But except for my kids, who are all beautiful. But the problem for them was in North China, it was incredibly harsh climate through winter. So they couldn't leave the rooms. So you're eating, sleeping, cooking, playing, everything in this one 3x4 metre with small children. Those families, about 20 of them, were in turmoil. They came to Gilkey and said, "We need to fix this." Gilkey said the obvious solution was that the 24 rooms with only two teenagers in each room are the place to find space. If we can just free up that space, because you've got two teenagers in one room, whereas you've got a whole family in another. And so they went to the families with teenagers, and he went with wide-eyed optimism. Three reasons: it's war, everyone's stretched. If ever there was a time to help each other, people would realise now's the time. Second, it's so obvious. The least space-pressured people were the rooms with teenagers in them. There's only two teenagers in each room. Third, the families that he went to were all middle-class, respectable, moral. Some were missionaries. And so he expected it to go very well. In fact, he said to the families who were coming complaining, because they had all the kids in their one room with them and so on, they said, "With a little persuasion, they'll understand and cooperate straight off. You'll see." Listen to his next sentence. "We did see. The moment we began to talk to the people on the list about the ways of giving the crowded families more space, trouble erupted. Not one person on the roster of eminently reputable British and Americans would cooperate. Some slammed the door in our faces, some received us only to argue it out, but one and all balked at it. I want to give you one particular instance where there was a particular family that is striking in their response, and it's a missionary family. And I tell you this because it's always good to have a go at yourself. Let me tell you what happens. He goes to one prominent missionary family. He calls the man, the husband, an intelligent, sophisticated, well-educated man. He calls the wife capable, respectable, wedded to innumerable social causes. She was very concerned to help. So he went to them with great confidence that they would at least help. Mrs. White greeted me, as I anticipated, with courtesy and graciousness. As I warmed to my subject, she expressed concern for the plight of these unfortunate people and assured me that she and her husband were only too willing to do what they could to help solve the problem. He was encouraged. And so he began to unfold the plan. And the plan involved taking a couple of the teenage kids and putting them in a dorm with someone just a few metres away from the parents' house so they could all get some space and spread out the kids. And they expected that this family would be very keen and helpful and so on. But as he began to explain the idea, he noticed a certain hesitation. It became harder and harder to get back to the practical details. Finally, I suggested that maybe I should come back the next day so they've had time to think it over. She thought that was a great idea. She says, "Why, thank you very much." She has a soft smile and says, "This will give my husband and me a chance to talk and pray about it." Scariest words I've heard. When I returned the next day, she seemed both more definite and more sure of herself. I was elated. Here at last was someone I thought who would take a lead, not in opposing us, but helping us. So we began to explain the details that they would take just their eldest teenager and put him with a group of other teenagers with a chaperone just a few metres away. And that would free up space and so on. But here's what she does. "Oh, no, no, we can't let that happen. We've talked about it and have made up our minds. We believe in keeping a nice home for our boys to come to, and that would be impossible if we brought three into our room, two parents and one of the children. As we talked last night, all of this became clearer and clearer. Home and family are so important in a place like this. We decided that our first moral responsibility in the camp is to keep a real American home for our two boys." And so she refused. This author became very agitated and in anger says, "Granted that home and family are important to everybody, Mrs. White, how about the real American home of the couple next door to you, the ones living with all their infants in the same room as them?" Now, do you see what's gone on here? A lady has prayed about it with her husband. She's thought about what's the godly thing to do, and concluded that the godly thing to do is not sacrifice her own comforts to help another family, but to guard and protect her comforts. And she's given a moral reason for it. "We are responsible to bring about an American home for our kids, and so we cannot help the others." And so she leaves the others crammed in the most despicable circumstances. Do you know his conclusion to all of this? It's a very insightful reflection on all that occurred. Listen to this. "Good people and bad people found it incredibly difficult, not to say impossible, to will the good. That is, to be objective in a situation of tension and to be generous and fair to their neighbours. In all of us, moreover, some power within seems to drive us to promote our own interests against those of our neighbours. We were not our true selves, the selves we wanted to be or like to think we were. We were caught willingly yet unwillingly in a self-love from which we could not seem to achieve our own release. Whenever we willed something, it was the will not to love others, but the will to actually go our own way. This is incredibly insightful. And this man then wonders, how did I not ever see it when I was back in America? That when you scrape back humankind's heart, what you have is a heart bound to self-love, bound to selfishness. How did I not see it, he says. His answer? When you grow up in a very affluent society, people can appear generous because they've got so much. So he said, when I'd go to someone's place in America, they were always very willing to give me a spare room, and it seemed so generous. But he realized now it was easy to give me the spare room because he had a room to spare. People were generous with their food and gave me extras because they had extras. But as soon as you don't have the spare room and the extras, the real nature of a human comes clear. And the will to self-love dominates. Now, I don't know about you tonight. I don't know whether you think to yourself, man, that wouldn't be me. If I was in that camp, I would have been the first one to lead the charge, to bend over to make it easier for others, and I'd cost and sacrifice. Naive. Naive. We see hints of it today that this is exactly how we are all. You go through school. School's a terrifying place because everyone's just ruthless with each other. And then you kind of say to yourself, it's just because they're kids. They'll grow up and grow out of it. But no, you just don't see them as much anymore. And if you did, you'd find the same thing happening. The point is this. God locked us into futility. And the fact that he only locked us into futility and didn't destroy us is his graciousness. Take great care that I don't misspeak about God and don't misthink about him. Our perspective on God is so powerfully corrupted we can't even see how bad we are and how amazing it is that God has given us another day. When you scrape back the heart, even of the best, of the moral, it's there. We are not the decent people we like to think we are. God sees the heart of sin and rebellion, and he judges us for it rightly. And his judgment upon us is to limit our life, to make it that our life won't go on and on like this, that there will be an end to it. And he gives us over to the desires of our hearts. Why? That we might come to our senses, that we might come to ourselves and see the fruit of the choices we're making and the consequences and where it's taking us and how dreadful and disastrous it is, and that we might realize we've brought this upon ourselves. And what do we do to fix things, to fix the world, to fix ourselves? Here's the big thing tonight. We can't do anything. You can't fix it. I can't fix it. I can't fix my nature. You can't fix your nature. We can't fix the world. We can't fix things, except in a most superficial way. We can't do it because our nature is the problem, and now God is the problem. He's against us. There's nothing we can do. We are helpless. Now, I've told this story often, but let me share it with you again. There's a man on a businessman who travels regularly, and over a two-year period, he's often traveling overseas. And eventually, after a couple of years, his wife discovers that on his trips, he's been conducting an affair with another woman. Now, she is devastated, destroyed, angered, and kicks him out. Now, after a short period of time, he becomes sorry and goes back to her and says, "I'm sorry, have me back." Now, here's the question for us all. Does she have to have him back? He said sorry. Does she have to have him back? The answer? No. She doesn't have to have him back. He, even though he said sorry, doesn't earn her forgiveness. He is entirely at her mercy. He can say sorry all his life, but unless she receives him back, he is locked out. And you know, until he gets that, there won't be any forgiveness. Isn't that right? If he keeps saying sorry as if that somehow should make her have him back, she would rightly say, "You fool, you're just compounding your own sin against me." His only chance is to actually realise that he is entirely at her mercy and he's done nothing now that's worthy and is entirely up to her whether she has him back, and he realises that. It's in that context that something can happen. Now you multiply that a million times and you get what's going on in our world with our God. We have walked away from our God, we've committed spiritual adultery, and God in his holiness is against us. What can we do? Nothing. We're helpless. We are totally at his mercy. We can't do anything. But you know, the most wonderful message and the truth of the Christian gospel, the biblical gospel, is this. God does something. God does something. He comes and he pays the price of our sin in our place. He takes upon himself the consequences of our sin upon himself. And you might say, why doesn't he just sweep it aside and forget it and forgive? Because God is not like us. The question was asked this morning. It's worth just reflecting quickly. Just imagine a judge in a courtroom. And his son comes before him, convicted of raping a 12-year-old. Should the judge, who is his father, just forgive him and say, let's just let this one go? Hands up if you think the judge should do that. We need the judge to stand for truth and justice and righteousness, yes? Otherwise, our universe, our world is a mess. God is not just another person. He is the judge, the holy judge of the universe, who cannot let sin go unpunished. But he is also our Father, who comes in the person of his Son and takes upon himself the judgment that's due to us, that he might be just in punishing sin, and the justifier of the sinful by showing mercy and grace, by having paid for our sin in our place. God, he who knew no sin, became sin in our place, that we might be given the righteousness of God as a gift. See, what can we do? We can't do anything. We're entirely dependent upon God and his mercy. But the testimony of the Christian gospel is this, that the God who is real, the God of the universe, has done something. He has come into our world and he himself has borne the cost himself so that his anger that's against us, that has locked us to futility, can be turned aside and so that we can now be reconciled to him. What can we do? Cry out to him for mercy. And if you do, be absolutely assured that God has given testimony of his grace and mercy in an event in history, in the cross of Jesus, that says, "I will be merciful." Not because you deserve it, but because I'm overflowing in love and I've decided to be gracious. Come back. come back and find mercy with God. Cry out to Him for forgiveness and find a new start where that locking us into futility can be removed. And we can have, according to Romans chapter 8, hope now, real hope, solid hope of a future where everything will be made new, where death itself will be removed because of the work of God, not because of anything we do. Friends, I'm going to pause and I'm going to see if Sarah's got any questions for us. Then I'm going to say a couple of words to finish. But let's see if you want to chew over anything on this by questions first. And then we will finish together.
Yep, so we've got a bunch of questions. The first one, how is death a problem? It's our only way to be with God.
Death's a dreadful problem for a number of reasons. And it's only not a problem because of the work of Christ. But death itself is a dreadful problem. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5, the Apostle Paul says that he would rather Christ return and just swallow him up into life than have to go through the experience of death to get to Jesus. Because the experience of death itself, where I'm dislocated from my bodily existence, where my body dies, is a dreadful thing. Now, because of Jesus' death, that death for me, who's in Jesus, is a pale shadow of what it would have been without Jesus. But it's still something that I don't want to have happen. I would rather Christ return. Now, it's a problem for another reason too, of course. My wife will go through death unless the Lord returns, and pray He returns so we don't have to go through death. But my wife will die to go to be with her Lord, my Lord. I'll miss her for a long time if she dies before me. She's convinced she won't. She's convinced I'll die a long time before her. But it's a dreadful thing. But softened because of the work of Christ.
How do you explain the good we do if we're so broken society wouldn't hang together to the extent that it does?
Yeah, you've got two things. You've got the fact that my nature is bent towards self-love, but I'm able to, in extraordinary circumstances and on occasion, work against that to do something selfless. But then I'll roll back down again. It's this gravity towards self and self-interest that I can overcome. It's work. Second thing is God in His grace actually continues to provide the world with He holds back the full reign of my sin. And so He holds society back from its complete anarchy that if we just let sin go all the way, it would happen in it. And that's God's restraining hand in His grace that enables us to continue to function in some fashion together. Hell will be the place where His restraining hand is taken away entirely.
Sorry, I've just got to open my
hand. You were so engaged in the answer.
I was.
Right.
How is it holy for God to be against us?
Because the God of the universe is a just God who must punish sin. So where He finds sin, He's against it. That's how justice works.
Yep. I've got a bunch more questions, but I might just quickly see if there's anybody from the floor that wants to stick their hand up and ask a question.
Is it truly naive to think that we would have acted the same? It's hard to believe that all of us in this room would have done the same thing. This is one of those tricky ones. The author of this book said exactly what you just said. He kept throughout his whole experience there saying, surely someone, surely not all of us. And he kept going, no, all of us. There were a couple of exceptions, but they were interesting ones. There was an instance where a family, a husband and wife and their young teenage boy, the husband and wife were quite violent with each other, and they realised that they were trapped in this room 3x4 throughout the winters. They realised that if they didn't get the boy out of that, it would destroy him. And so Gilkey, negotiated with the parents that we need to remove this boy. But where do you put this boy when you've got that story of the 9 men who wouldn't have anyone in their room? He did this. He found the group of men that would do it, and it was a couple of ministers. But it was a couple of men who had the humility to realise they were broken and fallen. And he went to them and he said, "Look, this is the circumstance. We really need to do something." And the older man said, "Look, we are really under pressure here. But all right, we'll do it." And they took the child on. Now, Gilkey's reflection was that there is someone who appreciated the grace of God and the transformation power of that sufficiently to have enough humility to pay the price of the cross for himself. But that was unusual and rare. Yeah. This is exactly the question. Is Jesus right? That sexual immorality, greed, lust, slander, murder, theft, is Jesus right that these come from your heart? My heart? Well, there's very few people today who think that is the case. And I'm trying to find ways to show you in the experience of history that it's always been the case. So we keep engaging together. And I'd love to have a conversation with you in 10 years' time. And I don't mean that in any kind of facetious way. I mean, it would genuinely be the case that in 10 years' time, married, kids, seeing other relationships and what happens with them, as you go through life, you begin to see these things play out in real world terms. And the theories that I have and the way I imagine things to be just doesn't cut it. This is the 70th anniversary, is it not, of Auschwitz? Now, if you've not read about what happened in the Final Solution to the Jews, you need to read it, because you need to find out what humans are capable of. So the question is, doesn't this have application in one sense to the whole of the Central Coast? I mean, you've just got a picture of a lady with a room and she won't share it. Is there a kind of an application of this to the Central Coast in the way whether we share or Australia, whether we share? Absolutely. Absolutely. And get this, this is no political comment. I think the issues are complex, but here's what I think I can bring to bear on this. Be very aware, learn to be aware of your own inner disposition to justify selfishness. Be very aware of the power of self-love to find moral grounds for self-love. It was interesting, Gilkey's reaction to that woman. I think I mentioned it very briefly, but he talked about her being very hesitant. But once she'd prayed about it and realised that she needs to create a real American home for our two boys, suddenly she was strong and clear and solid. And Gilkey's reaction is this, reflection. I could see that in her gracious but determined way, she was feeling more comfortable now that she'd found a clear moral principle to back her up. Brought up all her life in a moral atmosphere which assumed that anyone fully human would be morally responsible and cooperative, she couldn't reject anything except in a morally responsible way. Even when actually she was fiercely defending the interests of her own family against those of others in the community. And so I knew it would be very hard to pierce this armour of righteousness. The point he's making is this, our propensity is towards self-love and self-interest. But because most of us have grown up in reasonably moral homes, we won't just say selfish things and do selfish things. We will make it appear to ourselves that we're being very moral as we act in selfish ways. And so here's the danger. As we engage in the whole debate about asylum seekers and what should be done, complex issue, but be very aware of your propensity to come to a conclusion about this based on your own self-love and desires for comfort and security. You see, we've got a very big country with lots of room. Why should we not have more? Well, because it'll change my lifestyle. And I like my lifestyle. Do you see what's going on? And we'll find moral grounds to actually make that a case so that it sounds like we're being reasonable, respectable, and moral. Be very, very wary.
What motivation then do Christians have to do good in the world if the hope is in heaven? Should Christians be involved with social causes?
Yeah, it's a question that's come up a couple of times now. Thanks, Sarah. It's a good question. Look, it's the what motivates us to do good in the world is not the expectation that we can create utopia. If you think that by doing good you will change the world, you will be very energised for about 5 years and then very depressed and despondent and stop, disillusioned and angry. Right? The only ones who can sustain genuine efforts to seek to bring about help in the world are those who are very aware of the limitations of what we can do and yet compelled by the love of Christ, I just want to do what I can and I want to love in whatever way I can and do whatever I can in whatever... And that compels me to keep going, even though I know it won't bring great change, it won't transform the world, but it will help. And so we can help. And love compels us to want to help because we've been loved so much. But do it aware that we won't really change the world. The thing that changes the world is the gospel of Jesus. It's the message that there is a God who has acted to rescue us and to bring about a new world. And you can come to know that experience of being part of that new world if we would but come back to Jesus, aware of your helplessness before him, repent, seek his forgiveness, which he has established for us in the cross, cry out to him, and he will hear you, and he will give you life. Now, that'll change everything. And so we preach the gospel and seek to love where we can and make a difference where we can, just conscious it won't be massively impactful.